call this meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development to order for Wednesday, March 27, 2019. For the members of the audience, we're going to be going somewhat in reverse order of the bills, but just follow along, we'll get there. So I'm first going to open a hearing on House Bill 3200. Melissa, if you'd like to...
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3200 requires an applicant for either a marijuana production license or a marijuana grow site registration that does not own premises where the marijuana will be produced or grown to submit signed and informed consent of owner of premises to either the OLCC or Oregon Health Authority.
Very good. And so we have Representative Noble and James Crawford, I believe. So Representative Noble, if you'd like to start.
Thank you, Chair Lively, and members of the committee. Actually, LFO's recital of the bill pretty much states it. Right now, you have to show that you have a legal right to be. And,
you have to give us your name for the record.
And you want that up front?
Yes. Thank you. Well, you can do it anytime, but up front would be nice.
Thank you. My name is Ron Noble. I'm currently the state representative for House District 24.
Thank you.
What this bill does is actually provide an informed consent. So if you lease property and you want to get a marijuana production license, instead of just showing that you have legal right to be there, you need informed consent to present to OLCC from the owner of the property that says it's okay to have a marijuana production license. It's really that simple. And this is a constituent bill. Mr. Crawford brought it to our attention. I'm thrilled to be able to sponsor this for him.
Okay. And Mr. Crawford, if you identify yourself for the record and make your comments.
Bear with me. I am extremely hard of hearing, ear infection issues. My name is James Crawford. I live at 24955 Northwest Oak Hill Road, Yamhill, Oregon.
Thank you.
We own approximately 1,000 acres there, and we farm and forestry, and picked up a few extra houses along the way, which we made the mistake of renting. In September of 2016, I belatedly discovered that the tenants who rent a secluded house and associated barn on my large rural farm and forestry property in Yamhill County had entered into an agreement to enable their grandson and his associates to install a very large-scale marijuana grow in the 3,600 square foot barn. They had built four grow rooms in the barn that could accommodate over 300 mature plants and had plans to expand capacity to as many as 800 mature plants. With the benefit of hindsight, I believe that this grow had been in operation since February 2016. Although these marijuana growers claimed that their grow operation was legal, my attorney quickly determined that the documents that they presented to me were merely letters from the OMMP acknowledging receipt of their applications for medical marijuana patient cards. It was obvious that they had no grow site permits to grow marijuana for their own personal use, much less growers' licenses to grow for alleged patients. I found myself confronted with a situation where I had a very large-scale, unlicensed, illegal marijuana grow on my property. While the judges of Yamhill County may have decreed that there are no laws or regulations regarding marijuana, the federal government is not so lenient. I refer you to this press release from the Office of the U.S. Attorney for the State of Oregon in reference to the prosecution of a very similar bootleg marijuana grow. Please note the second to last paragraph in which U.S. Attorney for the State of Oregon states that the properties used for the illegal cultivation and illicit trafficking are subject to civil forfeiture. My tenant's illegal marijuana grow and associated drug trafficking was in itself an existential financial threat to my family. Finally, installation of the illegal grow had included major modifications of the original electrical system in the barn and house without permits or inspections, much less my knowledge or consent. These modifications included running new power cables to the barn, either from the main electrical panel in the house or possibly from a bypass of the electrical meter that had been ripped from the side of the house. The marijuana growers had also contacted PGE about the possibility of installing a massive 800-amp power supply directly from the transformer to the barn without my knowledge or consent. A typical home has only a 200-amp power supply. It should be noted that even if there are no problems with the electrical system, indoor marijuana grows are a conflagration waiting to happen. Since this rented barn abuts our forested property, such a conflagration could engulf hundreds of acres within an hour and threaten our timber, crops, barns, shops, farm machinery, our own homes, and our lives. We had thought we had an agreement with our tenant to vacate our house, but they reneged on that agreement. Since they had by that time removed and dismantled their illegal marijuana grow, Oregon's residential tenancy laws would not allow us to cite their grow as a cause for eviction. HB 3200 would begin to address some of the issues I've listed. Because of the substantial risks that large-scale grows can impose, landlords have the right to decide if such an operation should be allowed on their property. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Any questions, any members? Anything else, Representative Noble?
No, thank you.
Thank you both for testifying. We close the hearing on House Bill 3200, and I'll open a hearing on House Bill 3096. Melissa, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3096 authorizes an exemption for certain cities to impose a tax or fee up to 18% on the production, processing, or sale of marijuana items. It requires 2% of the proceeds to be transferred to the county for public safety purposes and applies to marijuana items produced, processed, or sold on or after January 1, 2020.
Very good. Representative Finley, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Bonham, Vice Chair Fahey. For the record, my name is Lynn Finley. I'm from Vail, Oregon. I'm a state representative for House District 60, serving Baker, Grant, Harney, Malheur, and the better part of Lake County. I'm here today to urge you in support of House Bill 3096. The passage of the recreational marijuana in 2014 created an interesting phenomenon for some of our border regions. Cities that border California, Washington, Nevada have not been deeply impacted because all of those states have legalized recreational marijuana. However, cities bordering Idaho, there has been a significant increase in people crossing the border into Oregon to purchase legal marijuana. An increase in our case of Malheur County of between 600,000 and 1 million people immediately across the border, within 55 miles of the border. As you can imagine, this has prevented various challenges, but most significantly, it has been an issue of public safety. During the past elections in November, the City of Ontario lifted, as a voter initiative, lifted its ban on marijuana sales, and in January of this year, the City of Ontario passed Resolution 2019-101, which sought approval from the Oregon Legislature to increase their marijuana sales tax to a maximum of 18% to help compensate for the costs associated with the influx of people coming into the region. It is important to note that this tax will only apply to the City of Ontario, not to Malheur County, not to Eastern Oregon, not to the state, only to the City of Ontario. Simply put, 3% local marijuana taxes rate is insufficient to cover anticipated demands on public safety. As an example, there are dispensaries north in Baker County. I've driven by those dispensaries at 9 o'clock in the morning to see a line of 50 people standing out in front to go in. The demand is incredible. The traffic jams are amazing on the freeway. If passed, House Bill 3096 would grant the City of Ontario the authority to bring this issue before the voters of the city and the citizens of Ontario. It would be up to the voters to decide whether to implement this tax or not. To conclude, I would like to introduce you to Mayor Riley Hill and Ontario City Manager Adam Brown, who drove all the way here from beautiful downtown Ontario, 415 miles, I might add. Once again, thank you for having me, and I urge an aye vote.
Thank you very much, Representative. Thanks for driving that distance.
Thank you. My name is Adam Brown. I'm the city manager for the City of Ontario and Chair Lively, members of the Economic Development Committee. We appreciate you having us here to speak on House Bill 3096. At the request of the Ontario City Council, our staff prepared a white paper based on looking at the taxation impacts of marijuana on our community. And specifically, our research question was, how will price impact consumer behavior? Price moving because of taxation. So a copy of the white paper should be on your dais, and I'll highlight a few points of that study. We reviewed professional and academic studies for this, and the primary source of our research came from the University of Oregon. And the University of Oregon watched how Washington had a supply chain tax of 25% on grows, 25% on production, and then 25% on retail. And they changed that taxation policy to a 37% retail tax. And so the University of Oregon said, that's really interesting. That should give us some insight into the elasticity of demand for taxation purposes. So what they found, though, was even though that was a reduction in taxation on product at the end of the line, that the base price actually went up, and it was the growers and the producers that took greater profits instead of passing on the savings to the consumers. So that study gives us a little bit of an idea of the sensitivity of price on the product there. The average increase was 30 cents per gram from the 75% total supply chain tax to the 37% retail tax. We also collected our own data from some border towns in Oregon and Washington because it's legal in both states. And we hypothesized that maybe the price was, there was a price difference in the Washington side because of the tax difference, 37% versus 20%. What we found, we looked at two markets. We looked at the Vancouver Portland market within 7 miles of the river, and then we looked at another market outside the metropolitan area, the Longview Rainier market. And what we found was that it was 19% cheaper in Oregon still, and 13% cheaper in the 19% cheaper in the Rainier Longview market in Oregon, and 13% cheaper in the Portland Vancouver market on the Oregon side. That's probably due to the supply challenges that the state of Oregon has had in terms of having excessive supply, not on price elasticity of demand. This research shows, and from many academic and longitudinal papers, that Oregon's tax policy on marijuana is very generous as compared to other states where legalization has occurred. Even at the most conservative estimates by researchers, marijuana is not sensitive to price. The research also showed that people would rather pay a higher price for legal product than to pay less for illegal product, even if it is going to be distributed illegally later. The real question of whether Ontario's taxation capacity should be higher than currently constituted is a question about location. The Treasure Valley of Eastern Oregon and Western Idaho has that population of over 700,000 people. According to Forbes magazine, it's the fastest growing city in the U.S., and they don't have access to legalized cannabis. The building across the river, because of the different taxation and social policies, goes on endlessly in Idaho, where we struggle on the Ontario side to get 3 to 4 new homes a year. Until marijuana dispensaries were legalized in Ontario this year, the closest retail shops were in Huntington, Oregon, about 30 miles from the border. The majority of the retail already comes from Idaho buyers. Given the convenience of being right on the border on Interstate 84, it is expected that most of that traffic will stop in Ontario to purchase their product. Additional users will come with even closer proximity. The inelasticity of marijuana shows that traffic will not bypass Ontario to avoid additional taxation. Many have questioned the coexistence of black markets and in terms of taxation policies. Oregon has proved that despite having one of the lowest taxes on marijuana in the U.S., there's still a black market product. The most frequent states where product is being exported is Minnesota, Florida, Wisconsin, Missouri, Virginia, Illinois, Arkansas, Iowa, Maryland, and Texas. It's the city's opinion that we need to tax it appropriately, according to good public policy, and address the black markets. We don't believe it should be looked at as an either or, but tax it according to good public policy and address black markets. In closing, Ontario already faces economic challenges because of the taxation policies between the two states. The retail demand for our citizens alone is estimated at $127 million in Ontario. Our actual retail population, because of good tax policies of no sales tax, is $619 million a year. Which means, if you do the math out, there's 56,000 people that are coming to use our city services every day for retail or job purposes. And as we've observed from our trips to Huntington, about 75 to 80% of the traffic is coming from Idaho plates. So with that, we request your support on this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Mayor, welcome.
I'm Riley Hill. I'm the mayor of Ontario, Chair Lively, and members of the Committee on Economic Development. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you regarding House Bill 3096. The additional marijuana traffic on an already strained community will tax our law enforcement, road systems, schools, and emergency responders. The Oregon High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area of 2018 Assessment on Cannabis Production and Distribution and consumption identified the local impacts associated with more widespread legalization of marijuana. The data in Oregon is not deep yet because legalization is still new. However, Oregon and their findings include a 2017, 6.7% of 8th graders and 20.9% of 11th graders self-reported using cannabis in the last 30 days. The rate of cannabis-related emergency department visits increased from 3.4 per thousand to 6.3 per thousand. Traffic fatality data indicates there was a 50% increase in motor vehicle involved pedestrian fatalities between 2013 and 2016. From 2014 to 2016, statewide totals of drug recognition expert examinations resulted in an increase of 66.28% in cannabis-impaired opinions. The Rocky Mountain high-intensity drug trafficking area is composed of Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, and Montana. Marijuana has been legalized longer in Colorado, so there is more solid data available on the impacts. Some of their 2018 findings on legalization of marijuana in Colorado were as follows. Since marijuana legalization, marijuana traffic-related deaths increased 151%. Since legalization, traffic deaths involving drivers testing positive for marijuana more than doubled from 55 in 2013 to 138 in 2017. In 2017, 40% of the drivers and 50% of operators involved in traffic deaths tested positive. 69% of self-identified marijuana users admit to driving and having consumed marijuana. Comparing the three-year average prior to recreational legalization, at the time of the survey, use in the past months increased 45% above the three-year average. Colorado past month marijuana usage for ages 12 and older is ranked third in the nation and 85% higher than the national average. College-age marijuana use increased 18% after legalization and 60% higher than the national average. Use of marijuana by youth increased by 5% post-legalization. The number of highway seizures in Colorado marijuana increased by 39% from an average of 242 seizures in 2013 pre-legalization and 336 post-legalization. There has been a 63% increase in task force marijuana-related felony arrests. Property and violent crimes increased substantially. Studies and feedback from school administrators have shown where marijuana is legal, is a greater presence in school and greater usage amongst youth. Most often, the product is taken from parents who legally purchase under a medical license or who use recreationally. We know that we'll have a greater prevalence in our schools, which will require more resources to address. I mention these statistics not to vilify the use of marijuana, which it sounds like I am, but I mention them only to emphasize the impact that it will have on our communities. On the community of municipal, county, education, emergency services, I have personally seen some of the benefits of medical marijuana. Many of my friends. The citizens of Ontario have chosen to have dispensaries in the city, and we are respecting their wishes. The data shows, however, that our law enforcement, firefighters, paramedics will respond to more calls because of impaired driving. We already have difficulty responding to our existing call volume because of the influx of people coming to work, shop, and recreate in our community. Marijuana retailers told us that that on average, a customer spends $112 per visit. We anticipate sales of around $29 million in our community, which would make, on average, 258,929 transactions. If we use a conservative estimate of 30% of the customers do ride sharing, the dispensaries still 250 annual additional trips through Ontario, or almost 500 additional trips per day. That would be significant to a town of 11,500 people. Undoubtedly, that will increase the number of accidents and wear and tear on the road. And that's not to say that the accidents are from impaired drivers. That's only to say that because there's going to be 500 new trips a day in there, we're going to have some more accidents. The state revenue sharing formula is imbalanced for a border city to state with a large metropolis that does not have access to legal cannabis. The local revenue share of state collected taxes is based 75% on population, which ours is only 11,500, and 25% on the number of dispensaries. Ontario will only be credited for 11,470 residents. However, we will have a market in the Boise metropolitan population of over 700,000. We will be receiving a disproportionate share of the taxes paid to the dispensaries in Ontario and collected and shared back to Ontario by the state of Oregon. This bill will remedy that flaw. Our city recognizes that in all likelihood, marijuana legalization will be normalized by either the federal government or one state at a time. The economic impacts of state taxation and state social policy make the difference of communities that are only separated by a river very stark. Our competitive disadvantages have impoverished our community over the last 20 years. We have a higher income tax rate. We have a higher property tax rate. We have a higher estate tax rate. We have higher power rates. And our land use laws are far more strict on housing and industrial development. We intend to use this additional revenue to, first of all, address any public safety services which already are scarce and prepare for additional demand. We also intend to use the additional revenue to pay down our city PERS. We must also implement an intensive educational program. Lastly, we hope to use the revenue to invest in our community infrastructure, and that is to say streets, parks, recreational amenities, downtown, et cetera, so that when the revenue dissipates, we are better posed to be an attractive option for new residents. We respectfully ask for your support on this important legislation for Ontario. This bill has the potential to change the course of Ontario for better for the long term. Thank you for listening to testimony, and I invite any questions that you may have.
Much. Any questions by members of the Representative Drazen?
Thank you, Chair. So it does sound like you have a unique circumstance specific to the distribution formula, given the size of your own community versus the market that drives in for legal pot. But I am curious, given the statistics and the study and all the information you guys shared with us, that if those are concerns for Ontario and a different tax rate's appropriate for Ontario, acknowledging that you do have some unique issues related to the distribution portion. Why wouldn't a higher tax rate be appropriate for any community that would, in fact, face all of those challenges as far as accidents, youth use, all of these other things for other communities across the state? Like, why wouldn't that broad argument be applicable to communities all over Oregon that are facing similar challenges with scarce resources at a local government level?
Chair Lively. We're a community of 11,500 people. We're going to be servicing an area of 700,000 people. We're unique. When the governor was over there 3 weeks ago, he said, just look out the window, Governor. You can see where our competition is right over there. And she understood that. And we have a police force for a community of 11,500. Now we're going to have 500 people a day more coming in, 500 more cars coming in a day. We're very, very unique. And we're just unique.
Representative Drazen, probably the biggest single issue and answer is the fact that the 700,000 people are from a community that do not have legalized cannabis. Any other city in Oregon has legalized cannabis, or the border city that's across that administrative border has it as well. So that's the biggest difference is all of the folks, the 600,000 to 700,000 people in Western Idaho do not have access to legalized cannabis. Their only point is to come to the city of Ontario.
And to that point, though, if you could have the distribution itself of the 3% adjusted, you would think having all those people come to your community would also mean you'd have that much more revenue in the community because of this resource. So I guess my point is if the number is wrong for you based on services for the local community, I don't see how it's not also wrong for other communities. And I guess I'm not being super clear on that. But the 3%, if you have all those people coming in, you're getting the revenues from that. It just might be in the wrong percentages given the challenges you have.
Chair Lively, Rep. Drazen, I think that's a great discussion for further appropriate shares and the distribution formulas of the 2014 laws. Mm-hmm. And I think that should be a conversation at another point. And I agree with that. I mean, I think that the pro rata shares may or may not be appropriate, and I think it's something we ought to look at. We're trying to solve an issue that in the city of Ontario that is emerging and very impactful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, thank you. I might add, Chair, I forgot to mention, and I apologize for that. There is a Dash 1 coming, and it deals with the election, the voter referral on the election. So, and that I was hoping to have it posted today. I don't know, Melissa, had you seen that or not? It's a very small fix to deal with the election.
Okay, Representative McLean.
I'm trying to make this cogent because that was a lot of information. I really respect the fact that you've researched it and looked at your community and trying to figure out how to solve problems. The biggest sort of feeling or emotion or policy thought that has come to my mind as we're in this room listening to so many marijuana bills this year is that we're still in flux. And it sounded like a lot of the report, and I've only had a chance just to look at it, just barely, but there are some pages in here that's talking about those influx conditions, and they relate to size, and they relate to border, and they relate to who started selling marijuana legally first. And so I wondered if there was anything in here that drew to if Idaho legalizes marijuana in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years, if that changes the conditions of some of the results that you've been quoting.
Yes, Chair Lively and Ms. McLean. I think the mayor mentioned in his statement, and it's also mentioned in the paper there, that we expect normalization over time. Which meaning that we expect at some point, and we don't know whether it's 5 years, 10 years, that it'll be legal everywhere in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And this bill would allow for that policy, that taxation policy, to change through a subsequent election if legalization occurred in Idaho. The city may want to reduce it or stay the same, but we recognize that revenue is not going to be there long term, so we're not planning on spending it on new programs. What we'd like to do is just make our community, put our community in a better position so that when it is normalized and that revenue is gone, that we're better off for it.
I'm going to hold my question.
Okay.
That's okay.
Any further questions? That's in the helm.
Mr. Chair, and thanks for putting this together. It's a lot of great analysis. And I can tell that you're wanting the benefits of these businesses in your community because they do bring revenue. And the idea is to push the tax rate to a point where the customers are willing to bear the weight of it, and by implication, those very businesses. And if we push the tax rate so high that the businesses can no longer break even, they're going to leave and you're going to lose the revenue that you want. So how will you determine, if we give you this latitude, which is a lot, it's 15% of what we do now, how do you determine what's just right? Because we've got the rest of the state, our current tax rate, I don't know if it's just right now. The whole industry the rest of the shops in the state are not like the shops in Ontario, unfortunately, because they're facing fierce competition with each other and the prices are spiraling down and businesses are leaving the sector every day, I think. So given that balance, how are you gonna, I'm really interested in how you're gonna determine what's that just right tax rate?
I think that just right tax rate is gonna be determined by market forces, because you're gonna have, now instead of two dispensaries over in Huntington, there's gonna be seven or eight in Ontario. So there's gonna be a lot of different options out there on where to shop and what to buy. We don't know when Idaho is going to legalize, but as sure as we're sitting there, sometime down the road, they will legalize. That will then, market forces will bring that to bear, and the city will have to go along with that because we will not want to lose as probably 50 or 80 employees at that industry, maybe even 100 people that industry is employing. We're not going to want to lose them. And so we'll have to bear that in mind and move with the conditions.
So just to follow up, so what I hear is you might start out at one place at 15% total, and then you might adjust up or down within a fairly short period of time just to try to respond to market conditions?
Economic forces always determine what's going to happen. Even no matter how much we legislate or what we do, economic forces in the end always take over. That's my opinion.
Thank you. This isn't really your obligation, but I want to bring it up, and the chair, please cut me off if I'm straying from where we are, shouldn't be. But we also had another bill brought to us by four Southern Oregon, Southwest Oregon counties, modifying the exact same statutory provision, because they have their reason why they want us to do a special rule for them about the taxes in those four counties, and now you want us to do a special different tax way means for you in Ontario. And on one hand, you are differently situated. On the other hand, it's the same statute, and we kind of have to make a state, maybe a statewide solution to local problems. But we have to weigh that, and I guess I just wanted to make sure we were all keeping an eye on the request. So perhaps if we're not able to be responsive to your request, it's because it's a part of a much larger conversation with other players who are having similar but different issues with marijuana in their areas. So I guess it was a comment, not really a question. Sorry.
You may be opening yourself up for a work group. I don't know. I just warned you. Any further questions? Again, thank you for your testimony. Thanks for driving over and providing the information.
Thanks for the time.
Thank you.
So I have Mike Getlin and Stephen Milland.
Is this somebody?
That's
place, I think.
I would just encourage people again. Unfortunately, we're already way behind and we started late, so succinct comments would be appreciated.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Mike Getlin here, the Oregon Industry Progress Association. Quickly, we appreciate the fact that city leaders are going through the thought process and the effort of figuring this stuff out ahead of time. I think it's a sign of how far collectively we've come in support of and in dealing with the industry. Just by way of quick explanation, if anybody isn't aware, the current rules are 17% tax collected at retail essentially goes to the state, 3% goes to local jurisdictions. And this is something, again, we're hearing a lot about. Rep. Wallens brought it up. We have to have a discussion about distribution. We're operating off of an old system that was designed before we had anything close to the amount of information that we currently have about what tax revenue looks like and what the pressures are on these local communities. So we hear it loud and clear. We get it. We're not supportive of a patchwork tax system throughout the state. It would have a lot of negative consequences, probably a lot of unforeseen negative consequences, including pushing more to the black market when we're trying to do exactly the opposite and pull, you know, more and more of the product into the legal market that we can. So on that note, absolutely, I would love to be on Rep. Wallen's work group, given the opportunity. So thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
And with that, I have a slightly different perspective. My name is Stephen Mieland. I am a resident of Ontario, Oregon. I'm also the owner of Hotbox Farms, which is the largest cannabis dispensary in Huntington. We also have the bulk of the sites secured for Ontario. So this is a bill that directly impacts me, my business, my family, and my neighbors. I shared lots of concerns when I first saw this bill come forth, especially when we talked about the white paper. Another capacity that I have in the city of Ontario is the chair of the Marijuana Ad Hoc Committee. That was a short committee that was formed to look at the impacts that cannabis would have on the city and what we needed to do about that. This bill was presented to that committee, and that committee actually rejected the bill and asked the city not to do it. However, the city did go forth and continue to support that bill. Some of our problems that we had with the bill was in the white paper. It doesn't take into any considerations that anyone else may do something. For instance, Huntington, I said, well, what if they just simply kept the tax lower? Even with the inelasticity of the price, you're stating that no one is going to come. They're saying, well, if this bill passes, they're probably going to, they need the same revenue that we do. However, once we actually saw the meat and potatoes of the bill and what it said in black and white, it actually precludes Huntington, which is just a very short drive up the freeway from Boise, with Ontario being in between. Very, very short drive to this $4.6 million that they would want extra in tax revenue on the $17 million of 2017 revenue that we produced. $4.6 million these customers aren't going to want to keep in their own pocket just to drive the short distance up to the next city. What I actually think we're seeing here is an attempt by a new mayor running on a very aggressive platform, no cannabis ever platform, to quite honestly look to thwart the will of the voters, even though we, by referendum and initiative process, voted to have cannabis in our cities, doing whatever they possibly can to single out their city specifically, jack up the tax rate so high that people won't actually come there. They'll continue going up to Huntington, and that would be a win for him and his constituents. I also get to go home and live with these people. However, I honestly feel that this is what is going on, and I feel that it's right for you guys to know about it.
Thank you very much. Any questions for either one of these members? Doesn't thank you both for being here. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3096.
I'm going to drop the ball a little bit on Representative Smith, who will be on his way.
Okay.
And so on these, we don't need to open them all at once. We can open them one at a time because he's planning to stay for all of them.
Okay.
So we can do that.
So I just open in order, doesn't make any difference?
Correct.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2366.
Oh, yes, sorry. Too many logistics today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2366 allocates $1.6 million of lottery revenue to the Oregon Business Development Department for grants or loans to the Port of Port Orford for redevelopment of the Port Orford Cannery.
Okay, and we're expecting Representative Brocksmith, but...
I did a late text, so...
So in the meantime, we have somebody from the Port, Tom, from the Port of...
Yes.
You want to go ahead and come up, or...
Sure.
Okay.
Some time.
Thank you.
Unspent Welcome. Time is wasted time.
That's right.
There he is.
I'll concede.
Okay. No, you can stay at the microphone.
I'm standing by.
No, please. No, you stay. Please. You can stay up there, too.
Sure.
After you, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. I got to get the right file here.
66.
Mr. Chair, honorable colleagues, David Brocksmith, State Representative, House District 1, which encompasses Charleston over to West Roseburg, down West I-5 to West Cave Junction, back over to the Brookings Harbor community at the California border. It's an honor to be in front of you once again, and I will tell you, I miss serving with you on this committee as we had a lot of fun and got to hear a lot of good ideas and economic development projects for the state. And, of course, my focus on rural Oregon. And this is one of those projects. The Port Orford Cannery redevelopment project is something that will bring a diverse and wonderful opportunity to not only the community of Port Orford, but the port of Port Orford. As you know, Port Orford is a very small and depressed community on the Oregon coast, but they've done everything right. It was the first Marine Reserve on the Oregon coast, and I was and been privileged to have served on the Redfish Rocks community team since its conception, which is the guiding community organization that has helped not only put the Marine Reserve together, but as a model for the Marine Reserve program in the state. And of course, President Calvinese has been involved with that for many years as himself. Port Orford has one of the most depressed school districts in the nation. You've heard me speak about this before. And the Port of Port Orford, more importantly, contributes over 35% to the local economy. This is a project that, and I'll let President Calvinese get into more detail. We worked very hard to get the funding in place, the ducks in a row, and this is the last investment that's necessary to be the last piece of that puzzle. So with that, I'll leave it to Port Orford Commission President Tom Calvinese.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I was just introduced. My name is Tom Calvinese. I'm the president of the Port Commission in Port Orford. And thank you, Chairman Lively and members, for giving us a few minutes to address this this bill, House Bill 2366. Obviously, I'm speaking in favor of the bill. Just to add a few details, and I'd like to make 3 points with you. A little bit of background, and then I want to talk about the fact that the port is undergoing some economic diversification, building on the strength of our commercial fleet. I want to talk about job retention and creation through this project and about how we situate this project in the context of an overall redevelopment of our critical infrastructure to revitalize our working waterfront. You just heard about where Port Orford is. I don't need to go into that, but you may or may not know that Port Orford is a town of 1,200 people that relies very heavily on the port's economic activity. As Representative Smith just said, it makes up about 30-35% of our local economy. As you know, also and I'd like to pause and introduce our port manager, Steve Portier.
Sorry.
Keeping up with the parking. Don't want to get a ticket. You can't afford the tickets. So we are situated in an economically disadvantaged county. Our unemployment rate in 2018 was 6.5%. And in spite of this, due to the highly productive nearby Rocky Reefs and our hardworking fleet, our port is highly productive. We land an average of $3 to $5 million worth of high-value seafood every year, and that translates into about $12 million in economic activity to the state. If you look at it on a per capita basis, Port Orford is among the most productive ports in Oregon. We've seen an increase in landed value of catch over the last 40 years, continues to increase, and the four highest years occurred in the last 10 years. So what we're doing now is we're building on that very valuable commercial fishery that's robust and improving. We have had three of our local fishermen build new fishing vessels in the last couple of years, all larger than before, all with greater capacity to hold product. And our small fleet of 30 family-owned and operated fishing vessels on an average year might make 2,500 trips to sea to land that product. And on top of that, we launch about 100 recreational fishing vessels and an additional 50 or so research vessels, which are often contracted by ODFW and other researchers contracting local commercial fishing vessels. And as our economy and our marine ecology changes around us, which we're all very aware of, how we have responded is by adapting to that change. And as a result, we've become stronger. As I mentioned, in addition to launching commercial fishing vessels, we also support research vessels and charters carrying students and scientists and researchers from Oregon State University, University of Oregon, ODFW, NOAA, and other researchers. That is a growing sector. They need access to not just the Redfish Rocks Marine Reserve, but the surrounding waters to study our fisheries and the changes that are occurring in our ocean that we have to stay on top of if we're going to continue to operate successful and productive fisheries. We have also expanded in the area of outdoor recreation, users that also need to access the ocean. One of our current tenants is a kayak tour operator whose business has increased every year for the last few years that he's been in place, and has added other additional tours. And we're now seeing bike tour operators and snorkel tours and scuba diving tours showing up. The result of all that adaptation and growth is the other element of this project is in the area of job retention and creation. So taking advantage of our unique oceanside location is facilitating the inclusion of a seawater delivery system as part of this, as an integral component of this project. This will retain our current live fish buyer, NorCal, and also attract new tenants that rely on this seawater system as part of their operation. In the materials I prepared for you, you'll see a list of tenants that have all committed to being tenants in the new facility. One of them is an existing tenant, NorCal. The rest are new, all attracted to this project because of that unique characteristic. And finally, I want to place this project in the context of an overall redevelopment of our working waterfront that includes an emergency repair of our existing breakwater, a $6.5 million Army Corps of Engineers project that will take place this summer. And in addition to that, next month, the Department of Transportation will release a funding opportunity through their build grant. And we intend to pursue that to upgrade our existing high capacity cranes and boat launching and product landing facilities, which I believe, Steve, didn't you tell me that the cranes were used on a World War II Navy supply vessel?
That's correct.
Yeah, so they're ready to be replaced. And because our dock is uniquely situated, our boats sit on a high dock, the only way for them to launch is through the use of a high-capacity crane. As the boats get bigger, the cranes are under more stress. We're seeing an increase in failure of the equipment. It's a severe safety issue, severe risk issue for damage, and we really have to get on top of that and repair and actually replace that equipment. So we're going to pursue that as well. And as Representative Smith said, this is last money in that we're talking about. We have a pre-proposal into EDA. They're standing by for us to submit a full proposal once we have a $3 million match. We have the other, we have the other half of that. We have the other 1.4. We are prepared to engage in a low-interest loan through the Ford Family Foundation's program-related investment program. We've met with them. We're preparing a preliminary proposal for them right now, and we expect that with your help, we can pull the trigger and get this project off the ground and be building it next year. And we're out of time. You may or may not know that the existing structure that's about, 80 years old, is collapsing in on itself. We have had to vacate that structure. Our current tenant does not have a roof over their head. They can only exist that way for so long. So we're really kind of under the gun right now. And the future of our port and really the heart of our community really depends on this. And with this, we're looking at the revitalization of a working waterfront that I think has a great future. And we're seeing this as a 50-year investment. And so I encourage you and appreciate your time. And if you have any questions, we're happy to take them.
Any questions that members have? Representative Barreto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about a lot of different things as far as the development here at the Port of Orford. This 160,000 was for the cannery, specifically for a cannery, though, wasn't it?
Can I take that? Okay, I think that there's a little confusion because we're talking about a building that was once a cannery. So it gets referred to as a cannery a lot. It's kind of hard to break that habit. And even in the community, people refer to it as the cannery.
Okay.
Even though it hasn't been a cannery in a couple of decades, it went through another iteration as an urchin processing facility and then as a live fish holding facility. But it has now it's become unsafe. And we do have an emergency situation where we need to act. And the new facility will hold the live fish functioning, live fish buyer, all of the other tenants that we mentioned. That'll include Oregon State University is committed to having lab space in there and a seaweed cultivation facility that will be in the building, all dependent on that seawater delivery system. So sorry for the confusion about the cannery.
How many people do you see employed there when it's all finished?
In terms of new employment?
Several tenants, yeah. You've got a tenant right now that works outside, you said.
Yeah, and there's, they have sort of a temporary ability to do that has a short shelf life. In terms of number of tenants that we expect, we're looking at bringing NorCal inside, having the university have lab and teaching lab space. Oregon Sea Farms, which is the edible seaweed producer, two other small seafood operators, Watson Seafood and Port Orford Sustainable Seafood, and a commercial seafood retail operation, okay. And the kayak tour business.
And which associates to about 20, 25 jobs?
At least. 25
employees.
Please, yeah.
McEwen.
And I think it's also important to recognize the retention factor because the majority of the fleet is dependent on those processors. And if we don't have them, then our fleet starts looking for another place to live.
Thank you, Chair Lively. A couple of things. I wanted to clarify something that you said about timing. It sounds as though you have some urgency with ODA grant money. Can this be, this session doesn't end until the end of June.
Right.
Is that a problem for you?
No.
Okay.
We have submitted a preliminary proposal that's been accepted and well accepted, well received, I should say. They are standing by for us to come up with the match so that we can pull the trigger on the full proposal, and that's a rolling deadline, so we're ready when you are.
Thank you. And just a comment, these small ports along the coast are just critical economic drivers in these small communities, and they're very important. Port Orford's done a wonderful job of continuing to move forward incrementally. It's $1.6 million in lottery revenue, so I'm assuming that this is going to go down to Ways and Means.
Yeah.
I'm happy to support getting it down to Ways and Means and wish you luck down there when you get there.
Thank you.
And just my husband surfs at Hubbard Creek all the time.
We love it. Me too.
Yeah, the crazy Norwegian, great place to have some seafood. Yeah. thank you for the work that you do and being welcoming to those of us who cruise through on a regular basis.
Always. Always stop. Don't just drive through, stop.
I just want to add, Mr.
I just wanted to clarify that. It's a little bigger than you.
Let's clarify. I thought I heard you say that your match is a loan from the Ford Family Foundation.
So we have, there's two components to the match. Half of it is grant funding through regional infrastructure funds. Through that process, we were very pleased to learn that our project was ranked number one, and we are putting those dollars into contract right now. We also secured a $200,000 grant through the Wild Rivers Coast Alliance, which is a regional philanthropic group. And the other $700,000 is going to be the sort of low-interest loan. That's the skin we're putting in the game. At least there might be more, actually.
I would ask a clarifying.
If I could just add, Mr. Chair, and Representative Grayson, the port has liquid capital that they could, in the tune of, is it $300,000 or $400,000?
Yeah. We have a reserve in place, in part because we have these sort of old machines that we got to be careful about them not breaking down.
The port of Port Orford is very unique. It's direct access to the ocean, and so the docks are pulled. The boats are actually lowered by crane into the ocean to go fish, and then product is hoisted out, and the boats are then hoisted out of the ocean on dollies and moved into place on the dock. And so that's how they're launched. It's quite a unique system along the coast. And President Calmanese is very modest. He assisted in also working with OSU Extension to bring a dive tank fill station there so we can expand on those economic opportunities to go ahead and scuba out in the Redfish Rocks Marine Reserve and, of course, the Orford Reef. He has assisted in bringing the OSU Field Station extension there. He's also runs the through his work with OSU, what's called the Fish Tracker Program, and I encourage you to look it up, which is putting a radio array through the Marine Reserve and the transponders on the fish, actually, to actually do studies on where these bottom fish, if you will, are and their movement patterns within the rocky shores of the Marine Reserve. But the interesting thing that he does find is he also gets hits off of other tagged fish, such as shark, that have been tagged elsewhere, that like to hang out in the Port Orford area. So
that's all anybody wants to know about. Are there sharks? Forget your research. Are there
there's
sharks?
There's lots of diversified work that's occurring in Port Orford, and the community has embraced, of course, the port because of its economic driver to the community, with the stewardship area that's supported not only at the county level, but also to the local level. And so I appreciate the consideration of the committee.
Thank you, Mayor. Thanks for driving up. We're going to close the public hearing on 2366. We have three public hearings left, and according to the time we have left, that allows about 3.5 minutes per public hearing. We're obviously not going to get through today, so I would like to get through as much as we can that applies to Curry County.
The assessor would be great.
Okay, so I'm going to open, but we're not going to get to everything because we have to be out of here at quarter till. So I'm going to open a public hearing on 2383.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2383 appropriates general fund to the Department of Revenue for the Curry County Assessor Pilot Program. There's a dash one, which changes the appropriation to $150,000.
If my assessor, actually, Jim Colin, can come up, as well as we can just bring everybody up. That way we can expedite.
And we are having some projector issues, so we may need to do this with slides.
Just one of those days.
Yeah.
And the slides, I assume, are in OLIS.
Correct. The slides are on OLIS.
Our intent will try to get through all of this, but at 2:45, we have to adjourn. So,
Mr. Chair, thank you so much. David Brocksmith, State Representative, House District 1. I'm going to leave it at that and let the assessor and the experts go through the legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Whoever would like to start.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. I'm Mike Coles, Lane County Assessor, also current president of OSACA. I'm here today to support House Bill 2383, the Curry County Pilot Program. Due to budget cuts and from Measure 50, limited and declining CAFA funds, declining ONC timber revenue, and increasing costs, many counties have fallen significantly behind on cyclical reappraisal cycles. Curry County is no exception. Prior assessment pilot programs such as District 1, Lane County 2015 pilot showed a positive return on funds invested. Districts that benefit include obviously schools, cities, counties, libraries, parks, water districts, and fire districts, just to name a few. And please remember, the returns on investment for pilot programs and assessment taxation are perpetual returns. They were returned year after year. In summary, OSACA supports House Bill 2383, and an investment in the Oregon property tax system goes a long way. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Please. Good afternoon,
Chair Lively, and representatives of the committee. My name is Jim Cullen. I am the Curry County Assessor, been the assessor in Curry County since 1989. Just to illustrate the issue that we're up against, many counties in Oregon don't have the resources to get out and do regular reappraisals of properties in their county. Prior to measures 5 and 50, counties were on six-year reappraisal cycles, which allowed counties to keep up with the inventories on properties that were out there. Since then, Curry, like other counties, has lost funding, and they've cut back on funding in the assessment taxation office, and it's limited our ability to get out and do those reappraisals. We do have the resources to get out and appraise properties that have changes due to permitted property changes, people taking out building permits. But in Curry County, many property owners are making changes to their properties without the benefit of taking out building permits. Changes such as paved driveways, decks, or small sheds may not require permits in many counties. Changes such as converting garages and porches to new living areas, new garages or new houses, or ag buildings do require building permits. If people make those changes without taking out a building permit, we don't become aware of it. The building permits are a discovery tool unless somebody tells us about them. This is an example of one such property. The people actually took out a building permit for the structure that you see there, a garage with some living area up above, and my office was able to get out there on a timely basis and pick that up. We went back several years later and found this. Those people did not take out building permits for the changes. And so on this property, what that causes for our districts is we were able to go back on this property for the current year plus the previous 5 years as an omitted property tax. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
I'll run that.
Perfect. and actually collect $7,000 in omitted property taxes. In Curry County, that meant about $3,900 went to schools and about $2,700 went to other districts. For the county itself to support not only assessment and taxation, but the many other services that the county provides, it only provided less than $500 on that property. But from the years 2000 through 2010, there were over $14,000 in foregone property taxes. That means that the schools didn't get $7,800. And other districts didn't get $5,300, and the county didn't get almost $1,000. This next picture is a picture of a home that was built without any building permits whatsoever. It also was built approximate date of about 2000. And again, we were able to go back and get some of that omitted property taxes. But still, there was almost $8,600 in omitted property taxes that the districts will never get. This is an example of an ag building. people can get permits for ag buildings without actually having to pay a building permit fee. And what we have found happening in Curry County is people will take out this a permit for this sort of building, but what we find is something, well, a single-family dwelling. And we did find this dwelling on a fairly timely basis, enough that there were no foregone taxes on this property, but we did go up back, were able to go out and collect over $6,000 in omitted property taxes. In the last 7 years, we've been able to mount a limited reappraisal effort. We visited almost 5,600 properties, which is about 28% of the taxable properties in Curry County. And in visiting those properties, we found almost $20 million in unpermitted new property values. In Curry County, the average tax rate is about $8.82 per thousand. That $19.9 million would raise about $175,000 annually for the taxing districts. Of that $175,000, over $100,000 would go to schools, over $63,000 would go to the other districts, and a little over $11,000 would go to the county for county services. From that history, it is possible for us to estimate the amount of value that is still left out there that is unpermitted, and we have estimated that there would be about a 2.5% increase in assessed values in Curry County. A 2.5% increase to the overall assessment roll would actually raise approximately $692,000 at that average tax rate for the districts. Most of that, again, would go to the schools, over $395,000. Other districts would get over $250,000. In the county, it'd get about $45,000. Cost of cure. We estimate that with one and a half more FTEs and appraisal resource, we could take our county from about a 15 to 20 year reappraisal cycle down to a 6 to 8 year reappraisal cycle and pick up that additional value so the districts are not losing the money. They'd be getting that additional $692,000. That amount would increase by 3% per year. And we figure it would take an investment of about $125,000 to $150,000 per year to address that. And so we have House Bill 2338. 2338 began in November of 2017 when members of the Assessors Association began meeting with members of LOC, Special Districts, AOC, the School Boards Association, and the Department of Revenue to discuss the issue and to talk about strategies to address the issue. The group reached a consensus on a pilot project, now House Bill 2383, to begin in Curry County to provide additional funding at $125,000 per year to provide that additional 1.5 FTE in appraisal resource. Curry was selected because we have that history of tracking properties, and we could make an estimate on what the return on investment would be. The group felt the pilot should contain the following elements. Curry County tax districts would share in that $125,000 investment as a percentage based on the Curry County property tax distribution schedule. The state of Oregon would pay $75,000 for the school's portion, since almost 60% of the tax we collect in Curry goes to schools. The intent is that the remaining non-school districts would pay the other $50,000. In order to receive the money, Curry County would be limited in any cuts they could make to the budget to reflect only the same percentage as other budgets were potentially cut in the county. The pilot should provide for at least 7 years of funding in order for us to get up to cycle. And the Department of Revenue would provide reporting requirements on the progress of the pilot, and we would get back to you and let you know the progress. That was the real abbreviated version. Thank you very much for having me here today to speak to you on this.
Thank you. Members, I'd like to ask for questions, but okay, Representative Marsh.
Was there a butt there?
Yes. Well, we're out of time, and there's other people who wish to speak, so I'm just trying to find if there's, we will get time, the committee will get time to talk more about this, but I don't know exactly how we will finish this up, because we are out of time, but thank you for the presentation. Those other members who have signed up to speak, if you'd like to come and just say a couple words, but anybody, is there, I don't see anybody here against this measure, but.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm available to answer any questions the committee has.
Thank you.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. There are just three cities in Curry County, Brookings, Port Orford, and Gold Beach. All three of them have signed on and said that they would put forth their percentage of taxes to get this pilot going. We're losing money by not having property assessed, and it compounds itself. So we believe this will be a return on investment that we'd like to see tried.
Thank you very much.
Chair Lively, Susan Morgan, Association of Corrigan Counties. AOC supports this very broadly. We were part of the work group. My testimony that's in OLIS gives you a little bit of history about how Curry County ended up in this place. But in my opinion, this is a bill that definitely should be moved down to Ways and Means. We're in the process of drafting some amendments that will tighten up the language somewhat. Mm. So we'd appreciate the opportunity to have this continue down in the Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Wittenberg. On behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, there are 32 members within SDIO that are special districts in Curry County. And I'd just like to echo the comments of the previous two testifiers and just say that Jim Colon is my favorite assessor. He does his homework. It's so fantastic. He really has worked so hard. Everything that we've asked, you know, if we're going to have skin in the game and we're going to pay into your fund to help get you on your reappraisal cycle. He's done every single bit of the work to get this bill to this point and really deserves a lot of credit, and we support the bill.
Thank you. Thank you all. I apologize for the short time.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, Mark Garst with the Department of Revenue. I'll be super brief. We have a systematic funding issue with property tax administration in the state. The main funding source for counties is the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Account. Those revenues have been flat. Counties are seeing increases in their costs across the board. We've seen staffing levels decrease dramatically. We've had an 11% decline statewide in county staffing since 2007. In these areas where the permanent rate is less than $2, we've seen a 20% decline over that same period of time since 2007. The department supports targeted smart spending for property tax administration. We think that this pilot project is just an example of that. This could be a model going forward for districts voluntarily chipping in money to help administer the property tax system. And so we will be very excited to see how this, if this happens, what kind of return there is on the investment. And we think that this could be something that we could see going around the state and in other areas.
Very good. Thank you very much for those comments. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2383.
Yes, Chair. So are we carrying this forward?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, members, we will be carrying forward to our next meeting, House Bill, hearing on House Bill 2384 and House Bill 2810. So those are hearings. And then I'm going to carry over work sessions. So I'm going to carry the work sessions on House Bill 2053, 2174, 2613, 2672, 3110, and 3211. We're adjourned.